In one form or another, we humans are obsessed with violence. Whether watching true crime shows on television or witnessing fictional blood orgies on the big screen, we tend to find violence clearly compelling, a contention proved both by our box office estimates and by the crime-laden lineups of such cable TV channels as Oxygen and Discovery. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two different studies in big screen brutality: John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, and the Netflix offering Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
In 1967, the Monterey Pop Festival brought together a now legendary roster of artists, including Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Otis Redding, and music would never be the same. Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, co-host of Movies 101. Join me, Dan Webster, and the Spokesman Review's Carolyn Lamberson at the Bing Crosby Theater on June 12th for a live discussion of music in the movies, followed by a screening of D.A. Pennebaker's concert film of the Monterey Pop Festival.
Don't miss our display of memorabilia from the 60s provided by 4,000 Holes. Thanks also to event donors The Cleaning Authority, Strong Solutions, and Vino, a wine shop. Monterey Pop at the Bing Crosby Theater, June 12th at 7.
It's going to rock the house. Tickets are now available through Tickets West.
I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that likes a fight scene or two, maybe even three, as long as they're done with style and originality and maybe with an underlying moral theme, though that latter requirement clearly is optional. And it's a good thing we do, because in the pantheon of violent movies, a clear sense of morality has, at least since the late 1960s, been something filmmakers either have added as an afterthought or left out entirely. We're going to discuss two such studies in violence this week, one being the third in the John Wick series starring Keanu Reeves, John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, and the other being Joe Berlinger's look at the serial killer Ted Bundy, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, a Netflix release that stars Zac Efron and Lily Collins. Let's begin with the third but hardly last look at a deadly hitman facing an equally deadly array of enemies. I said before that movies featuring violence tend to view moral themes as optional, and it's true that John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum does operate in a moral environment. The basis of that morality, though, is ironic, a sort of code of honor among evildoers. In other words, it's okay to kill someone, but don't ever, ever do harm to his dog. In this third outing for John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, our anti-hero picks up where he left off in 2017's John Wick 2, which followed the 2014 original. He's on the run after violating the so-called rule of the International Assassins Guild he once was a member of, before he got married, succeeded in leaving the killing game, and owned a cool house, a favorite car, and a dog. But when he lost all his anchors to a normal life, he embarked on a course of revenge that put him on a collision course with his former employers, and is now being hunted by pretty much every assassin on Earth, all of whom are intent on collecting the $14 million bounty on his head. The result, as presented by director Chad Stahelski, based on the original screenplay by Derek Kolstad, is an ongoing bloodbath involving every kind of death possible, including my favorite, murder by horsehoof. But whether this amounts to anything other than mere mental self-stimulation is a question each of us will have to answer for ourselves.
Yeah, I think this is one of the few action movies, at least one of the few that I can recall, that puts all of its best stuff up top. Usually, an action movie will save its most elaborate, its most insane, its most bloody set piece until the very end. But John Wick 3 opens with a gauntlet throw of about a 20-minute stretch that has three fantastic action sequences, at set pieces, I guess you could call them. The first one is in the New York Public Library, in which he takes out a guy with a book and then puts the book back on the shelf where it belongs. That immediately transitions into this elongated knife fight that happens in this old curio shop where he and these henchmen are basically throwing hatchets and knives and throwing stars at each other. And it just keeps going, and it's insane. And then he immediately goes to what you just referred to, a horse stable, where a horse is used both as a weapon and as a getaway vehicle. And I was sitting in the theater thinking, is this going to be my favorite movie of all time? Because it was so fun, and the audience was reacting to it out loud, and I was reacting right along with them. And then I think the movie comes to a dead, screeching halt, and as soon as he travels to Casablanca and you get this material with Halle Berry and you find out about the moral implications of this entire network of assassins, which they have explored in Dribs and Drabs in the earlier John Wick movies, I found myself kind of losing interest. I think it picks up again. There's another pretty great set piece in the middle of the movie involving Halle Berry's attack dogs, who are almost like the stars of the show here. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you have this thing that's kind of inspired by the Bruce Lee movie Game of Death, where John Wick is going up these various levels, and each level has a new bad guy on it that he has to fight, and everything's glass, and he's just smashing into everything. And that kind of has
I was thinking of Lady from Shanghai also.
Oh, sure,
the Orson Welles
with,
movie.
With the Hall of Mirrors sequence.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, there is... is kind of like a Tex Avery slapstick element to all of these movies because the violence is so heightened and yet so visceral at the same time. Like, you can really feel those blows landing, even though I don't think there's any logical or scientific way that any of the stuff in this movie could possibly happen. I mean, the stunt work, I think, is mixed with a lot of CGI. I think that probably helps. But I don't know if John Wick movies need to have elaborate mythology, if they need to have intricate inner workings, if they need to be more than 90 minutes long, because this movie is 130 minutes, and I really felt it, especially in that middle hour. But I think there's a good 40, 45 minutes in here that are really sensational, especially those first 20 minutes. If it had just been 100 minutes of just one bad guy after another attacking John Wick and he has to MacGyver his way out of it, be it with a giant tome or with a trusty steed, then I would be completely into it. But I have a feeling that these movies are going to get longer and more elaborate and talkier, and I hope they don't, because I like it when this is just meat and potatoes action filmmaking, but with a surrealist, almost slapstick bent to it. I think that's what this series does best. I still liked this movie. I should say that. I still liked this movie, John Wick 3, for the most part, but I want them to go back to basics.
Well, that's good to know.
That was a long
because
pause.
John Wick 3 was not my favorite movie of all times and not my favorite John Wick movie either. As a matter of fact, in contrast to your response, Nathan, after 10 minutes, I leaned over and asked Dan, why am I here? And then 10 minutes later, at the end of that sequence, I said, why am I still here?
You didn't like the knife fight with the hatchets and the throwing stars?
Okay.
That was so much fun.
Okay. The thing is, you are referring to this, and Dan did something similar in his intro, to this as all being comic book, over the top, et cetera, et cetera. But there are real people who are being sliced and diced and hit and shot and so forth, and it's just too much.
Like, yeah, but they're all assassins, so they're asking for it.
Yeah,
they ventured into this pact,
Oh, I missed that. I didn't know that. And the good news is there were no children were harmed in the making of this movie, although I must give out a warning to people. Please, please, please do not bring your 6 and 7 year old kids to this movie.
There were kids
who populated the screening that we attended, because I think there's the potential of scarred for life
here.
Yeah,
maybe.
Okay, so here's the deal. You know what you're getting when you see these movies. This one was, as I said, even a little bit more violent. Not gratuitously so, because it is what it is. But there were things about this that didn't work for me. I mean, the whole notion of this high table, you know, it's very sort of religious in its metaphors throughout. That
very Catholic.
Right.
Yeah.
Very. OK, I should say that. Very Catholic. And to me, that's religious. So I think
that scans.
Yeah. So throughout, there's this representative from the high table who keeps appearing. And for some reason,
the adjudicator.
Right. I needed to have someone who I related to in some way on some level. And this
particular you didn't like that actress, did
actress
you?
Did not do it for me. I don't know why. I think that she just did not seem to fit the role of what she was supposed to be doing. We didn't want to like her in any way, of course, because she's one of the bad guys, even though she's a woman. But I just didn't connect with her. And so that part didn't work for me. I really did like Keanu. I mean, you have to like Keanu because, you know, he just does this with such earnestness
yeah.
that it's hard to dislike anything that's happening. I agree with you. As splendiferous as Halle Berry is, I don't think in John Wick 3 that whole plot line worked. I loved seeing Morocco, but I still think that they could have handled that differently. But as you said, does it matter?
Well, I think the movie cares a lot more about its own plot than at least I did. When the movie slows down and they're explaining their motivations and their past, I thought, I even think when we reviewed the original John Wick on the show, I think we talked about this assassin hotel, and I said something like, I'd like to see more about the inner workings of this universe. And now that they're getting into it, I'm kind of
You're
eating
like,
my words because
yeah.
I would just rather it be this pop comic book kind of thing
yeah.
because
a revenge film, which is exactly what it is.
That's what the original one was. Yeah. And I think it's why it's still my favorite.
Right.
Yeah,
of
me
the three.
Too.
Right. I want to refer another franchise that Keanu was the big star of and was one of the ones that really cemented him as an action star. And that's the Matrix trilogy,
which gets a very explicit call out in this one when he says guns, lots of guns.
Right.
Yeah.
And the very first, The Matrix, was a brilliant film. It was a classic film because it presented this mythology in this world. And then it was all action. Okay, let's here's how it is. How are we going to fight these bad guys? But then as that franchise went on, it got more and more mired in its own mythology.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening here. I don't need to have John Wick go out in the desert like the Mel Gibson character in Peter Jackson's movies about,
Mad Max.
Mad Max and the Mad Max. You remember Mad Max too?
Yeah, George Miller.
George Miller, right, exactly. I don't need to have him go out into the desert and then collapse and then find himself with the master of the high table.
But I liked it when Mad Max went out into the desert.
No,
I didn't like it so much here.
Well, he was sitting on a horse backward with a big clown's head. I mean, what's not to like about that? But I don't need that from this one. I just need John Wick, as you say, on motorcycles, on horses, running and fighting. Let's face it, you have to give, at least in John Wick 3, and all of them, but particularly in John Wick 3, you have to wonder what's going on with these other assassins, because they'll get him down on the floor and then they'll stand there over him, take a break or whatever, and go,
and say, it is my pleasure to fight you.
It is my pleasure to fight you. And then that allows him to get up.
There is a very Tarantino-esque black humor running through these movies
mm-hmm.
because once you're in the...
That's the
once
saving grace of
yeah, once
films.
You're in the Continental, you're not allowed
Lance
to
Reddick,
kill anybody.
Lance Reddick, by the way, is the concierge, is terrific.
Really good.
As
yeah.
is Ian McShane.
And you're once you're in the Continental, you know, it's like it's Sweden, basically. You're not allowed to fight.
Switzerland.
Switzerland, excuse me. And I like when he says, I'm such a big fan of your work. The main
yes.
guy that's trying to kill John Wick
yeah.
says, I'm curious to see where these go, but I wish they would dial it back.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Probably not.
At any rate, that was John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the Netflix special Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101. I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum. Let's now move to something a bit more real, Joe Berlinger's look at serial killer Ted Bundy. Berlinger is a familiar name to most fans of true crime documentaries, he being half the directing team, along with Bruce Sanofsky, of the 1996 true crime study Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills. In Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, Berlinger opts for a narrative look at the crimes of Ted Bundy, the infamous killer of multiple young women across several states, including Washington, who was executed by the state of Florida in 1989. Berlinger's is hardly the first film study of Bundy, there being at least seven others, beginning with 1986's The Deliberate Stranger, starring Mark Harmon. But it avoids reenactments of the murders themselves and keys mostly on Bundy's relationship with Elizabeth Kendall, whose 1981 memoir, The Phantom Prince, My Life with Ted Bundy, is what Berlinger used as the basis of his film. Yet other than casting Zac Efron as Bundy and the English actress Lily Collins as Kendall, both of whom are exceptional, it's not clear what else Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile has to offer that's new. Not, of course, that many true crime fans will care in the slightest.
Absolutely right. I don't know what other people's reaction to this film will be because some of my students have seen it and they were not as familiar with the Ted Bundy story as I imagine most people of a certain age who lived in Washington in the 1970s and 1980s might be. But as you indicated, Dan, there is a huge fascination and fan base for true crime dramas, whether they be reenactments, documentaries, and so forth. And I must acknowledge my interest in this particular genre. Of course, I pass it off as doing research for the courses that I teach in criminal procedure and so forth. But I do think that this story is not going to be as familiar to some people as it might be to us. The thing that I was fascinated by in this movie is the fact that Berlinger chooses to use the Kendall book as a jumping off point for framing this particular movie. And this book has been out of print for a long time. And I think perhaps because Elizabeth Kendall wants to remain anonymous, I was surprised that she participated in this film at all.
And Kendall itself might be a pseudonym. I mean, she's been identified over the years under several different names.
Yes. You're right. I thought the acting in this film was amazing because Ted Bundy is one of those super charismatic people who we used to call a sociopath or a psychopath. I guess he had antisocial personality disorder, but he was a true charmer, and Efron captured that completely. And Lily Collins, who I always like, did a good job as well. My familiarity with the story is through the Anne Rule book, The Stranger Beside Me. Mm-hmm. And she is one of the classic true crime writers, rest her soul. But she actually knew Ted Bundy and had worked with him, I think, on a hotline
crisis hotline.
And so the reason why I like The Stranger Beside Me is because it's autobiographical in part, and then it shifts tones and gets into the actual details of the crimes and so forth and so on. I don't know if we can say that we ever really would be able to understand Ted Bundy. Toward the end of his life, prior to his execution, he decided to blame pornography for everything that had gone wrong in his life. And I think that that was a convenient foil to try to explain his motivations and so forth. But I think if you like this genre, I would tell you, hey, watch this movie. It has a very unwieldy title. But
Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile.
Right. I think you'll get an understanding of what maybe true evil looks like, not from the John Wick movies, but from real life.
Yeah, I don't think so. I really admire Berlinger as a documentarian. You mentioned Paradise Lost, which I think is one of the great documentaries, but also Brother's Keeper, which we've talked about many times on the show,
which is
a masterpiece. And even that documentary made about Whitey Bulger a few years ago. In fact, he even made a documentary as a companion piece to this movie called The Bundy Tapes, which is also on Netflix, and which I think sheds more light on him and on his kind of cultural impact than this movie does. This movie was really frustrating for me because The casting gambit of Zac Efron as Ted Bundy is such a good one because he's like a more handsome version of Ted Bundy, but he does resemble him and he does have this kind of cold, sociopathic iciness to him. And I wish the movie around that performance were better because I think the performance suffers because I think there's a huge cognitive dissonance thing going on here between what the movie thinks it's doing and what it's actually doing. Because this movie believes, I mean, considering it's based on Elizabeth Kendall's memoir, I think it believes it's telling the story through Elizabeth Kendall's point of view, and it very much is not. It starts out doing that.
Right, I agree.
Because we meet her, and then Ted Bundy comes into her life, and of course there's the dramatic irony because we know what happens with him and how he turns out and she doesn't. And she, I mean, she has spoken about it in the book. You know, she talked about the fact that she didn't believe, even when he was convicted at trial, she didn't believe that he had done these things because he had gaslit her and convinced her.
Although
so completely.
She was suspicious at an earlier
point.
Sure. But
I mean,
she didn't get any cooperation from law enforcement.
Right.
So she was like, I don't know.
So she was kind of in the dark. And I wish that was what this movie was about because I think too much of the movie is focused on Ted Bundy. I like the idea of telling the story of a serial killer and making the serial killer a supporting player in his own story.
That's a really
that's
good
what,
point.
That's what David Fincher did with Zodiac. And it's so much more powerful. And it's also not about the serial killer. It's about the people he affected. And so at the end of this movie, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, when it has the tenacity to put the names of his victims on the screen, like as some kind of memorial, I thought, get out of here. That you're exploiting this as much as any other crappy Ted Bundy movie before. So I just thought this movie had this piety about it that I found really offensive.
So what prompted Berlinger to direct a narrative film
I don't
on
know.
This
he's,
subject?
Oh, he's done another narrative
well,
film.
The only
on
other,
this subject.
The only
though.
Other
oh,
narrative film I can think of is that horrible Blair Witch sequel that he
yeah,
made
oh,
you know, 20 years ago. So
but,
I think but, he needs to stick to nonfiction.
All right, but let's be clear here. I think the movie is made in a competent, efficient way. What you're talking about is the themes he tried to follow. And the mistake was the one quality of the film is the performance of Zac Efron. But the mistake is if you have Zac Efron, you can't make him a secondary
exactly,
character.
Exactly. Exactly. Here's another thing is that Elizabeth Kendall, I think, is still kind of a cipher in this whole thing. Like, I don't really understand what makes her tick any more than I understand by the end what makes Ted Bundy tick. Because even though we're sitting there and we have the cultural knowledge of who Ted Bundy is, so we're seeing the sociopathic tendencies, the movie keeps those a secret. Because we
except
don't see him kill anybody until the very, very end.
Except for the moment in which they're going to go and pick up a dog at the pound. The dog
right.
lets
the
us
dog,
know.
The dog knows. Because dogs in horror movies, and this is in some ways a kind of domestic horror movie, dogs are always the smartest characters.
One thing we have to point out is that the title comes from what the judge said to Bundy as he was sentencing him. He called him extremely wicked, shockingly evil, and vile. Not him,
the crimes
that
yeah.
he committed, so...
And then we have the overarching question, why are people drawn to these true crime stories?
Well, only you can answer that, Mary Pat.
And
well,
I can't tell you exactly.
I mean, I can kind of speak to that, too, because I find true crime fascinating, but I also find our fascination with true crime fascinating. I think it's because so many of these stories are rooted in the mundane. This idea that this single mother starts dating this guy that just seems like
the
perfect catch. And yeah, the phantom prince, as she called him in her book. This idea that he could come in and potentially rescue your lives, but the entire time that he's with you, he's doing all these horrible things. The fact that there could be somebody living next door to you or sitting next to you on the bus that's capable of these horrible things, I think compels us in a way that, I mean, it's different than like ghosts and monsters. And it,
or
it's,
if you
it's
watch Snapped, they could be living right in the same
right.
house with you.
Which are captured by two of the titles of the books, both of which were made into movies. The Deliberate Stranger, The Stranger Beside Me.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
It's like, how well
do you, really know someone? Yeah.
And how evil can a person be?
And I wish that this movie got to the heart of that question, and I don't think it does.
Yeah. And that was Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevernan for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again seek out quality cinema wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from Robert Downey Jr.'s character of Sherlock Holmes in 2011's Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. My horror at your crimes is matched only by my admiration of the skill it took to achieve them. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.